begin by saying thank you very much for the invitation from Linda and Pam to come here and present today and talk to you a little bit about the work that we've been doing at Victoria University in Wellington. And in the same vein, I'd also like to thank the co-team members of my project, because this is very much a team presentation. And you'll realise as I talk that there's a group of us who work together on both the analysis of the workplace data and also the adaptation and use of that data in the language in the workplace communication skills course. And on the front here we have a photograph of Nikki Ridderford, who some of you may have heard present on similar sort of on our work at a different forum last year, who is actually presenting tomorrow, no, today, in Melbourne at the regional ANEP forum. And she's actually the person who teaches on the skilled migrant communication course. So I'm going to talk a little bit about today, small talk, and you can see I've just started with a cartoon, which is traditional. And you can see it also identifies some of the topics that the person at the desk identifies as the typical topics. The weather's not so hot, the wife and kids are fine. No, I haven't had my holiday yet. No, I didn't see last night's TV. A very cooperative, or rather uncooperative, member of the workplace, as you can see. But it does highlight some of the topics that are typically used in workplace small talk in New Zealand and possibly in Australia too. You might like to think, as I talk today, about how much of what I say transfers across the Tasman and whether there are differences that perhaps we should be aware of when we talk to our New Zealand migrants as opposed to Australian migrants. So just a little outline of where I'm going today. I'll talk first about a little bit about the project, just describe to you what the Language in the Workplace project does, very similar to the AMEP Research Centre's work. Then I'll describe the Professional Migrants Communication Skills course and the ways in which small talk features in that course. And then we'll look at how Nikki actually helps with a variety of exercises to develop the socio-pragmatic skills of the learners in that course, particularly in the area of relational work or work kind of particularly focusing on small talk. And then we'll look at how those particular couple of students transfer those skills into specific workplaces in New Zealand. And finally, we have time, I'll just give you some evaluation from both the students and the employers who employ the students. So that's basically the outline of where I hope to go. And I thought I'd just start with a little bit of actually Australian data. Michael Klein at Monash at the time, he's in Melbourne now, was one of the inspirations for our work. And he's been a great mentor to me, and I'm full of admiration for the work he's done. His early work on language in the workplace in Melbourne produced a variety of different materials, and one of them is this little clip, which illustrates very nicely the sort of problems that can arise in small talk at work. It's based on some actual data he collected in a multicultural workplace, and they just got a couple of people to reenact the actual incident on which this is based. So I'll just play it for you.
Don't even again. Good. Now you get 5 days off. What are you going to do? You get 5 days off for Easter. What are you going to do? Are you going somewhere with your family? Excuse me, what do you want?
Now you can probably guess that the Vietnamese worker here was actually very befuddled by why her supervisor was asking her what she was going to do over Easter. She didn't see it as relational talk and small talk. She was a bit worried, in fact, that perhaps she was going to suddenly have to do some overtime. And so she was very straightforward about, just tell me what you want. And this was very typical. And so it's a good example of the sorts of problems that can arise, which don't occur to people for whom small talk is just the natural way of establishing good relationships with colleagues in the workplace. So looking at the broader context of the Victoria Project, you'll see here that we've collected data in a large number of different sorts of organisations, ranging from government organisations where we started, through corporates, two factories in Wellington and the Auckland area, some smaller businesses in the Hawke's Bay, the East Coast area, some medical interactions between nurses and doctors and patients, and a number of IT companies. And we've got a large number of interactions, therefore, that we've transcribed and we can use for analysis. And the sort of data collection process that we've used in all of these is to actually ask the participants themselves to collect the data. So we keep out of it ourselves. We don't go in and observe, which is, I think, a difference from the AMEP research approach. We persuade people to carry around something a bit like this, a little tape recorder and a microphone, and to record their everyday interactions. We ask them to do this for about 2 weeks and collect for us about 6 hours of just their normal interactions, including, you know, the beginning of the day talk, their normal work talk, any meetings they're involved in. It's a very successful method when it works, when you can persuade people to cooperate, because you get very realistic, authentic data. And sometimes you get people competing in the workplace saying, no, I'm recording this one. This is mine. So this is just to show you a little bit from
to
the factory.
To answer this question, we asked workers from successful factory teams in Auckland and Wellington for help. They agreed to be wired up to enable researchers from the Language in the Workplace project to study their workday conversations.
Some of you may recognise George Major here, who was one of our research assistants at the time, and who was a very efficient person in wiring people up. She actually had to go along at 6 o'clock in the morning to the workplace meetings where the supervisor would address the group each morning and tell them what their objectives were for the day and give them hard stick about what they hadn't managed to achieve the previous day. So she was a very committed worker, as you can tell.
To help answer this question, we asked
Now, in terms of the sort of analysis we've done, you can see there's a big range of different areas we've looked at, and that small talk is just one of these. So there have been a number of students who've done PhDs in this area, ranging through directives and requests to power and politeness. We've been looking most recently at the concept of leadership and how people actually construct themselves as leaders in the workplace or effective managers, looking at both men and women, and looking in our most recent work at Māori workplaces and seeing different ways in which Māori leaders behave, construct themselves, ask people to do things, get things done in the workplace. So that's been a recent area of work that we've worked on. So looking more specifically at small talk, the sorts of questions we've asked have related to things like, you know, what sort of topics are appropriate in the New Zealand context for people to use in small talk? And these are very different from one culture to another. What's an appropriate topic? You will all be very familiar with this because of your own experience of different cultures with talking to different migrants. What level of detail is appropriate? You know, if you're talking about health, which is a very common topic, how detailed is it appropriate to be about, you know, what you're suffering from just at the moment? Where does it occur in interaction? Is it at the beginning and the ends only, which is where people tend to assume, or does it occur during meetings, which is something we actually found quite commonly, between topics, for instance, in a meeting, and that often through people who are not used to that. How much is appropriate at any point? You know, who stops it and how long can you go on for appropriately? And what can be achieved through small talk? What, besides the obvious establishing good relationships and solidarity, you know, some of the side effects are often not quite so obvious. So it's quite an interesting area just to look at these sorts of topics. I'll just give you a couple of examples from our authentic workplace data, and then I'll show you later just how Nikki uses this particular example with the migrants in the workplace communication skills course. So this is a very typical example. The Diana, the senior manager, Sally's the administrative assistant, comes in, comments on the weather. Sally says, "Don't know what we're doing here, we should be out in the sun." Just exactly what Linda said yesterday when she was talking about us all working hard in here. "Pity about the work, really," says Diana, who's the manager, remember, and then comment about the kids, and then notice that Diana's the one who moves the talk back to work talk. So it's a very typical little bit of interaction. Next one is a good example of a very safe topic in the workplace, work. So being busy. being busy is a very safe thing to say, and we've got lots and lots and lots of interactions like this. Busy, busy, busy. Terrible, isn't it? Another one. Haven't seen you for a while. Well, I've been a bit busy. And there's something which often throws our migrant workers. Must have lunch sometime. And many of them comment that, you know, this is a common way in which people interact with them in the corridor or first thing in the morning. And then they never hear anything about the lunch. Somehow or other goes off the agenda. So a bit disconcerting. And this one from a commercial organisation where Clara and Peg, at the end of the meeting, are having a little bit of small talk. So it's been quite a long meeting. Clara is the director, the manager of this particular organisation, and she's talking to her team member, Peg, who's pregnant. And so she asks about the baby, and you can see that Peg gives her some information about the fact they can't tell its gender yet. And then Peg says, you know, but it's summer. Last time I wasn't quite as pregnant in the summer, so it was easier. And then, interestingly, at the end of this little, you know, very sociable little interaction, so you're hoping you're going to work through, says Clara. And this is the beginning of a little conversation about just how much leave she's going to need and what sort of arrangements they're going to need to make and so on and so forth. So it sort of segues very smoothly from social talk to a little bit of sort of work talk and then back again. And that's very common and, again, very confusing for some of the migrant workers who are just not used to people introducing such a personal topic and then suddenly switching back to a work topic. So this is my transition to the work. So, the importance of relational talk, which is really the focus of most of what Nikki does in our course, which I'm going to talk about now. You know, that relational skills are crucial in the workplace, and not everybody has them. Some people have to actually have them honed up a little. And the course director, Angela, and Nikki over on the right, on the right for you. And the programme is basically an intensive course for people who are underemployed or who have been unemployed for 3 years or more. And the goal is to try and help them develop communication skills, which will help them in New Zealand workplaces, and to give them a little bit of New Zealand work experience, because the course includes a placement component as well. The people who come into the course have IELTS 6.5 or better, and they're all people with bachelor's degrees or workplace experience, so they're pretty experienced people. I think the minimum level of English, 6.5 for IELTS, that's right. And what happens in the course is that they have 12 weeks of full-time fee-paid commitment to the course, and the first 5 weeks are spent in class with Nikki doing exercises of a variety of types, and I'll give you an example of one of them in a moment. And she has lots of units based on our workplace research data, transcribed and then used in the classroom in the form of role plays and exercises and so on a whole variety of different aspects of relational talk, so small talk, requests, clarification, refusals, complaints, the sort of things that are often difficult to do if you're a new worker in a workplace, you know, to actually disagree with somebody or say you can't work late, that sort of thing, because you've got something that you have to do. And then that's followed by 6 weeks of work placement, and Nikki does a fantastic job of getting all these 12 of our interns each time, into a workplace appropriate for their skills. You can imagine how demanding that is, trying to match the skills of the particular student to the particular needs of a workplace that happens to be willing to take them. So that's a real collaborative effort, and Nikki's skills in that area are outstanding, and she has a lot of contacts in the community. Her husband happens to be the chairperson of the Rotary Club, which is a distinct advantage, because Rotary have been a wonderful support for this course, not only in helping us find places for people to be to act as interns, but also in actually helping out on the course, as I'll mention in a moment. So they have 6 weeks in the workplace, and during that time they come back one afternoon a week to report on how they're getting on and what sort of problems they're having and to raise issues that have come up that have puzzled them. And that's been very useful for us, because Nikki makes notes on those and we get lots of examples of critical incidents where things, misunderstandings occurred because people were not tuned into the same wavelength and had different expectations about who could tell them what to do or who they had to take notice of. And then at the end we have a classroom follow-up. So it's quite clear that relational talk is recognised by employers as important. They comment frequently that it's not the task-based skill, the ability to do the job, that's the problem when these people go into their workplaces. They're often extremely competent, often very much more experienced in some areas than the people in the workplaces. One young woman, for example, was employed because she had particular expertise in a computer program that they just started using, and she was an invaluable resource for them, and they were very appreciative of her skills in that area. But the relational side of things is quite different and might very well not measure up to their task-based skills, their professional skills. So here we get an example where Sarah didn't know whether to say hello in the lift or not, or whether she should get into a conversation, or whether it was polite to be quiet and silent. And this is a very common sort of question, you know, how do I respond in a particular situation? So just going back now to that example and looking at what Nikki does in the course with the sort of exercises she uses, you can see here that Nikki's drawing attention to the sorts of obvious features that that we as native speakers just know and take for granted. So typical topics, weather and so on, is, you know, obviously a good topic. I was just noticing when I was talking to Alan this morning that we talked about the weather over breakfast, and then we talked about travel arrangements before I came in here. So the sort of safe topics that we all know about are just sort of taken for granted things. She asked them, can they tell in this interaction? She gives it them without the contextual information that I gave you earlier. And she says, can you tell who's the boss? And very often they can't, because they think that Sally's very forward, making this comment about, you know, the fact that we should be out in the sun. They say, you know, it sounds like she's a lazy person. What would her boss think if she says this sort of thing? What are the clues that these two know each other reasonably well? She asks them. You know, would it be acceptable in your culture to ask about the boss's kids, for instance? And, you know, how well do you need to know somebody to do that? That joking is okay. You can joke with the boss in New Zealand, and this again is news to many of our migrants who find it just totally unacceptable to think about the idea that you might joke with the boss. And I can see many of you nodding. And obviously, this is a very familiar piece of information for you. Who speaks first and why? You know, who can start the small talk is quite important, and who finishes it. So usually it's the superior who moves into the workplace talk, into business talk, transactional talk. And you can see how Diana does it very nicely here, just through an email. It's quite a sort of subtle way of moving things on. So it's quite a useful way of highlighting the sort of dimensions of status, solidarity, the importance of the context in which you're operating, the formality of the situation, and the function of the interaction, these basic sociolinguistic dimensions that we hope to try and raise the awareness of the students. We don't try to teach them formulae. We don't try to teach them facts about New Zealand talk. We try and help them to become aware of how to do the analysis themselves, how to work out, well, you know, how well do I know this person and what does that mean in terms of what I can say? Or what's my status relationship? And in the New Zealand context, what does that mean in terms of what's appropriate? Because it's much more useful for them to be able to analyse the situation themselves, because we can't possibly hope to cover every possible context that they're going to find themselves in. So if they know what to be aware of and what to be sensitive to, that's much more useful. Another quick example where Tom is actually asking for a day off. So he leads in with a little bit of relational talk. So he says, can I just have a quick word? Great weather, so the weather topic again. Did you get away skiing, he asks his boss. And then, now how can I help you? Moving to work talk. I was wondering if I could take Friday off and make it a long weekend. So, you know, the work that Tom does in softening up his boss for this request to have a day off is, again, quite unfamiliar to many of the migrant workers that we talk to. So these are the sorts of questions. What's the function of the interaction? Could this sort of interaction occur in your experience? And it just highlights for them some of the ways in which the New Zealand norms are different, and that formality and how well you know somebody can, you know, intimacy can override it. If you know somebody well, can override just about any sort of interactional constraints that you might have otherwise had. So moving now to looking at the research, which is based on when the participants went into New Zealand workplaces. We've got 11 case studies. I was interested that your parliamentary secretary yesterday was talking about the importance of moving to case study research, because this has been the only way, really, that we've had any hope of getting the sort of data that we think is going to be useful for us in working out whether what Nikki tries to teach in the course actually gets transferred into real, authentic workplace interaction in the classroom. And I know that Ingrid talked about making assumptions about classroom not being real and workplace being more real, that there is a sort of transitional issue, because very often they feel safe and comfortable, as many of you talked about yesterday in your presentation, in the classroom situation, and suddenly when they get into a workplace, they find themselves very scared and not wanting to open their mouths. And of course, all those important ability to do this relational stuff that they've learned in the classroom just disappears out the window. And so we're very keen to try and look at ways in which we can help them reattach that knowledge so that they can reuse it in the situations they find themselves in. You see that there's a range of backgrounds in terms of countries and a range of occupations that of the 11 people that we've followed into the classroom, into the workplace situation. And we've recorded data from the places where they've been. So they themselves have been wired up, and they've asked the people that they're working with for permission to record. And we've got, of course, a permission in advance from the workplace to do that. I have to say, this is very, very, very hard. It's probably the most difficult thing we have to do, because whereas we've had reasonable success in the earlier research where we could select our workplaces, we could work with people who expressed interest in our work, and we could use our contacts and friends and colleagues and people who would act as a vouch for us and so on. Here, we have much less choice, because these are carefully matched people to particular workplaces, and we don't want to muddy the waters for them. We want to make sure that their experience in the workplace is positive, and then asking to record as well on top of that, of these very generous workplaces who have agreed to take them, is just another demand. And so it's been a very sensitive area for trying to collect this data. But as I say, Nikki's been a very successful and effective person at getting people to cooperate as much as possible. This is the summary of the data we've got on each of those 11 participants. And I'm not going to go through it all, but if you just take a quick glance over it, you'll see that there's a lot of it. There's role plays, beginning, midpoint, and endpoint of the 12 weeks. There's retrospective interviews. We ask them to look at the role plays we've recorded and tell us what they see and think about them and what they think they've learned about, from doing them. We've recorded group discussions about the sorts of issues and miscommunication that come up. And then in the workplace, we've got a whole range of further data. We've got data from the first 2 weeks that they're in the workplace, so at the very beginning of their internship, and then at the last 2 weeks at the end of it, to try and see if they've made some progress during that time in their ability to fit into the workplace and feel reasonably comfortable. And this data is... we've just begun to analyse, so we've only really touched the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's going on here. Okay, so just giving you an example of a role play description. This is an example from based on a real life situation that people had told us was a problem, as I mentioned earlier. You're in the lift with your CEO, your manager, and you've got to start a conversation. And then you arrive at the first floor and you've got to get out of the conversation. So these were role plays that each of the 11 participants, in fact all the people on the course, did, and we recorded the 11 case study participants. So here's Helena, who I'm going to talk about in a couple of examples, right at the beginning of the course, and she's role playing being in the lift with her CEO.
Hi. Good evening.
ridiculous. And this was exactly the sort of problem that was so typical. So it's interesting. Her comment on this was, it's hard. She said, in our culture, we try to avoid talking to people. And so that's what she did. She did exactly what was appropriate in her own culture. She tried to avoid talking to the CEO. This little photographs here are quite nice examples of how Nikki's taking the videoing the rotary volunteer who's actually working with a particular participant here. The rotary people not only help us in placing people in appropriate workplaces, they also come in and help with things like doing job interview practice. And they will have conversations with the workplace interns about, you know, the sort of work that they work in. And they're all really, some of them are, you know, the top CEOs or very senior managers in businesses who voluntarily give this time once a week, sometimes once a month, whatever they can afford. And it's absolutely invaluable for the workplace participants, as you can imagine. Not only to give them the practice of, you know, a real person with a genuine experience to do the job interview practice with them, but also it often sets up networks for them that they otherwise would never have a chance of having. So they've got a contact in the business community who then has an interest in them and who will, you know, bear them in mind and maybe mention them to other people. So it's a very, very valuable aspect of the programme. Well, this is Helena at the end of the course. Doing her small talk role play again.
Oh, hi Angela. I had a good time. Isn't it party nice?
It was great actually. I was surprised to see so many people there tonight.
Yeah, yes. I met some workmates we would work before.
Right.
I don't know if you remember them or not, but they are all in good shape. It's really, really glad to see them.
Right, and which team are you with?
Oh, the marketing. Marketing
right.
team.
Well, marketing
team. Really exciting team.
Well, it's done a lot of good work for the company this year. We're absolutely delighted at the number of new clients you brought in.
Wow, I'll tell my boss. Do you have any plans for holiday?
Well, yes, I mean, I just hope to have a bit of a break, really.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's good. That's
right.
Good. And, okay, Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you as well.
Okay.
You can see that Helena's moved on a little in terms of her ability to cope with this situation. I mean, it was frozen again. Okay, so you can see that she takes the initiative at various times. She introduces topics that have been suggested might be appropriate, you know, about holidays and Christmas and so on. And she introduces the topic of her workmates. So a lot more confidence and ability to keep the conversation going. One of the things that we often point out to the skilled migrants in our classes is that they seem to leave all the work to the other person, and you know the other person is carrying the conversational burden. And you can see here that Nikki's really done a good job in helping Helena learn to take up her role in the conversation and carry the conversation in a more equal way. So what happens when they venture into the professional workplaces? So we tracked, as I mentioned, the interns into particular workplaces. I've mentioned the challenges of data collection and the fact that it was quite an ask, really, getting cooperation. But if we look now at how Helena copes in a real-life situation with handling the small talk situation, she's here talking to Edward, who she's working alongside and who's acting as a sort of mentor to her. And his comment, 3285, is at the end of a little bit of transactional talk they were doing. And then notice he is the one who introduces a non-work topic. He says, you know, where do you come from? Where in Wellington are you? And she says, Lower Hutt. And then I catch a train and go into the campus to do some schoolwork. And then if we look at the next page, I'll just play this a little bit. You can see, just notice how she manages to move on from just being responsive.
That's okay, less than 15 minutes.
has really, really good walking exercise in the morning. What about you? Where do you? So when you do the offshore one,
yeah,
I think maybe much more difficult than this one.
No, that was much easier.
So it's interesting because we've got her, first of all, saying, you know, what about you, where do you live? So she's having the conversational small talk back to him. You can hear also that it's quite a noisy office with phones going and background noise, which is another of the problems we had, of course. Some of the transcripts are a bit hard to hear. But notice she's the one who actually moves back to transactional talk, which is quite interesting. And this is an interesting example to discuss with her, because this was fine because she and Edward got on very well. But if she'd been in a situation where she was with a superior, this might not have gone down quite so well, that she was the one who decided that, okay, that's enough of that small talk. We'll move back to business at this stage. So it's quite a subtle judgment about whether that's an acceptable way of behaving. So sort of problems that we've been identifying from our recordings. Some workers have trouble managing the boundaries between small talk, social talk, and work talk. You know, just where exactly and how do you move from one to the other? And the other one, the other main one, is just sustaining their role. How much of it should they be doing, and how much of it is acceptable in different contexts. Okay, so look at Helena's comment here on her small talk at work. She says, I made a lot of mistakes. I just used to ignore the social talk. And this was very, very common, that particularly from Chinese culture, she's from Hong Kong, people would comment that, you know, they basically just wanted to get on with the work and demonstrate that they were good workers. And so they avoided the social talk. They didn't get involved in it because they wanted to prove that they were hardworking. And I had a very interesting experience myself when I went to Hong Kong earlier this year, because I was actually working in an academic department for 2 weeks and doing a variety of things, talking to people there. And when I arrived first thing in the morning, the first couple of mornings, I walked in and I'd say, good morning, and, you know, a bit of hot out there today, isn't it? And the administrative assistant looked at completely puzzled as to what was going on. And then one of them said, yes. I thought, something going on here. And I realised that this was just the converse of what we'd had here from Helena. That basically you were there to work, not to have a nice social chat. And that basically in the first thing in the morning, it wasn't appropriate to spend time or waste time, as they saw it, on social chit-chat. So it was quite a salutary experience just being on the other side of that, seeing how it worked from the point of view of a person for whom social talk seems so much to be taken for granted as a normal thing that you did at the beginning of every day. And notice she says, in the second quotation here, I've got nothing to say. People got their own topics, but I've got no confidence to stand up and say. I can only say short sentences, and this, I think, reverberates with many of the comments that came up yesterday and the sorts of presentations that people were talking about there, where people were not confident about having something to contribute. Just a couple of examples from one other workplace participant, Andre, who was actually a Russian background. This is an interesting one. I'll just play the...
It's on the Victorious workplace.
English professional practices.
Oh, yes, yeah. And so he's working...
But anyway, I'm really from the University of Otago.
Oh, did you?
Department of Children. We love it. 2005.
And he goes on... The next bit is what I really wanted to focus on.
I know all the names. just a girl sitting when people are students are gone.
Oh yeah, I was in the fire service down there. We were very quiet at the first place.
Now Andre doesn't quite get it right. First of all, he knows all about Dunedin, having been there for a couple of years. But also, it's a very small place. Now New Zealanders are very sensitive about size of their cities. And Dunedin is one of the four main centres. So actually, Andrew is quite right. By Russian standards, it is a very small place, but it's not the sort of thing you should say in small talk. So these sorts of issues have come up and are very unavoidable. But of course, you can hear that it's a very good-humoured and friendly sort of workplace, and Andrew did learn how to cope with it all in the long term. Okay, so I'm going to wind up now with some comments about the sort of evaluations that we've had from people. The employers that we've worked with, and again, this reverberates with some of the comments that came up yesterday, the employers generally comment that they get as much out of the sort of involvement with the course as the interns do. They said that they originally thought they were giving to the programme, that it was, you know, basically they were being generous employers. But they found that the input of the school migrant was often very, very valuable. And we have we have graduation ceremony for the migrants, and we also have regular social get-togethers. So they come back together about 3 or 4 times a year, and all of those who've been involved in any of the courses offered twice a year, will come back to those get-togethers if they can and share their experiences and so on. And they, many of them demonstrate that actually their professional expertise has been really valuable to the workplaces they're in. One of them commented that recently the place she was working in had started commercial operation in China, and suddenly they found there they have a native speaker of Chinese, and they hadn't expected to, and she became an invaluable component of the team. Some employers are very open-minded about diversity, and this is something we're trying to work on as the next stage of our research project, is to try and encourage employers to be more tolerant of diversity. So rather than teaching the employees to fit in to the New Zealand norms, which is of course important, and certainly that they need to be aware of what the norms are so they can choose to fit in if they wish to, we'd also like to focus on the attitudes of employers and try and encourage them to see different ways of doing things as acceptable and perhaps even, you know, interesting and valuable. This is a particularly enlightened manager who's used as a model of that sort of open-mindedness.
We employ a number of people who have graduate degrees. They come looking for a job. They're often not able to get a job because they're overqualified. Now, these people are only looking for a job perhaps for a year or two to get that New Zealand experience to get into their chosen career. We find a number of them actually stayed and become our managers, and the others, they've moved on to their career, and we've celebrated that with them. But what have they brought to us? They've brought experience, maturity, they've brought, you know, educated, easy to teach, responsibility, reliability, great set of qualities they've brought to us, and 1 or 2 years of really good employment with somebody like that is really worth having. I'd advocate that to other people.
So he's unfortunately probably not all that typical, but certainly a good model to have. So what about the migrant workers' evaluations? Interestingly, we get many comments from the post-course interviews, and this one, my close friend said, "You sound bossy." I heard that a lot, but I didn't take it seriously. This is very common that people would say, you know, people tell them that they sounded bossy or too direct or whatever, but they couldn't really take it seriously. They couldn't believe that people really perceived them that way. But now she says, from the course, I take it seriously. I think about it all the time. And the second comment about the fact that she was surprised that people in New Zealand don't complain very directly. She thinks that if you complain directly, it'll make the waitress improve. New Zealanders, however, she says, tend to complain more indirectly, and she realises that this way is actually more acceptable in New Zealand. So, you know, people have to really come to terms with the fact that ingrained norms of ways of behaving are just perceived in a very, very different way in the New Zealand context. And finally, some comments on the cost-benefit analysis, which were undertaken by Nikki's husband, who is a law accountant, a tax accountant, and unfortunately this course is under threat at the moment. The fees from the course have been paid by the New Zealand government for 12 scholarships, basically over the last 5 years. And At the end of 2011, that's going to be cut. The national government has just decided that basically any program or any initiative under $2 million is going to be cut. So this is one of them. So in order to try and counteract this, John Preble, Nikki's husband, has been trying to put together a demonstration that this course has economic benefits for New Zealand. And you can see it is quite an interesting bit of evidence that for every taxpayer dollar, we get a benefit of about $98. And he says the reason for this is that the government expenditure is for 12 weeks teaching and internship, but it captures more than 25 years of experience, education, training, and so on, for each of those interns. So basically we're getting a really good return on our investment. And this, hopefully, this argument will carry some weight. And just to summarise, in the 5 years that the course has been running, most of our students are getting permanent positions in the longer term, that within 6 months of finishing the course, 85% are in some sort of permanent role. So it does seem to me that it is having some effect. So thank you very much.